listening to IsraelScene.com.
And you're listening to IsraelScene.com.
Listening to IsraelScene.com.
Seen through the eyes of Steve, that's myself.
And you're on.
Two characters passionate about everything that happens in Israel.
IsraelScene.com.
You're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And we're here in the studios in Tel Aviv.
In delightful Tel Aviv. I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit about what's happening politically in this, in our surroundings. Of course, the most pressing, the most dramatic event going on now is the upcoming conference in Annapolis, Maryland, in the United States. The idea being to further the prospects of peace between Israel and the Palestinians, between Israel and the Arab world. This has stimulated a lot of interesting statements and writings, both by the professional diplomats involved and negotiators, as well as by the correspondents and the journalists. And I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit about that.
Let's go.
Well, the Haaretz newspaper is well known for its traditional left-of-center position of the newspaper itself, and certainly of its writers and correspondents. So I thought that last Friday there were some very interesting articles and op-eds in the newspaper. One of the news stories was by Danny Rubenstein, who's been very well known in Israel and a very sympathetic journalist as far as the Palestinians are concerned, very critical as far as Israel is concerned. And in this week's paper, he writes about the Palestinian Authority as a sinking ship and how many of the leaders, most of the leadership, or much of the leadership, has actually left Palestine, the PA, and have moved back to their previous homes. Several of them have homes in Cairo. A number of them have homes in Amman. And those who haven't left have sent their wives and children out. Living in the territories now is just too difficult between Israel's, the various moves Israel has made, the roadblock and the conflict with the Hamas, and the basic lawlessness that pervades the authority, the Palestinian areas. A part of which I can understand has to do with Israel and the way we have been dealing with the authority and the Palestinians. And the other part that is not really being mentioned has to do with your legacy of the former Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. And I found it interesting that the article was illustrated by a photograph of a poster of Yasser Arafat, just his face. Must be a huge poster. The face appears to be like about 5-6 feet high. And right below it, showing the scale, is a Palestinian soldier policeman. And also in the press a little while ago were photographs of young Palestinians observing, celebrating the anniversary of Arafat's death. Not celebrating, but observing it. They just unveiled a monument to him.
$2 million the monument was.
And the celebrations around that and the legacy that he left, from their point of view, a very positive one. And I see, it appears to me that part of his legacy is this level of violence, uncontrolled violence in the authority. One of his techniques was to absolve himself of all responsibility for acts of terror undertaken by people who he claimed to have no control over, some of whom were actually members of his political organization, the Fatah, and others of whom were members of other political organizations that were constitutes of the PLO itself. But he managed to set it up as if he couldn't do anything about it and it wasn't him. In the liberal world, we used to hear about the concept of one man, one vote. And under Arafat, it seemed to be one man, one gun. And everybody was armed and everybody. And that was a technique that he used to first of all, maintain his own power by stimulating the different factions to be antagonistic to each other. And it was also a way of attacking Israel and not taking responsibility for what his people, the people that he supposedly was leading, was doing.
So what did he? What's he saying about this whole mess?
Well, he's saying he's not making a value judgment. Rubenstein is just reporting on the fact that the Palestinian Authority is disintegrating, that the Jordanians are coming in from the east to Judea and Samaria, and that one of the leading Jordanian advisors to the king has just spent a long several weeks in Judea and Samaria speaking with the leadership of the authority, and that the same kind of thing is going on between Egypt and Gaza.
So we're back to Judea, Samaria is Jordan and Gaza is Egypt.
Well, he's intimating that that well could be the direction things are going. I remember that when Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Shamir shared the prime ministership, one for 2 years and the other then for another 2 years. And when they weren't prime minister, they were foreign minister. And when Peres was foreign minister, he had meetings with King Hussein in London, and they had agreed on a plan in which the Jordanians would re-enter Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, and assume administrative responsibility and control. And Shamir nixed it when it was his turn as prime minister. There are many people who thought that this would have been a great alternative to the intifadas, that this would have avoided the intifadas, that the Jordanians would have controlled the Palestinians and not allowed them to
would have killed
to
them
create
if they,
all of that
if they created
that
problems
mess.
Like they've done in Jordan.
That's one. Of course, you can never really tell, because people in politics don't necessarily follow straight lines. Another interesting thought on that subject was that in the period immediately preceding Israel's occupation of Judea and Samaria, that the Jordanians, Hussein, King Hussein, was encouraging the Palestinians to use Jordan as a point of transit on their way out of Judea and Samaria and into moving to the rest of the world, and that there was a process of Palestinians leaving that area that was quite significant, and the Six-Day War put an end to that. And of course, once Israel took over, at a certain point, the Jordanians' King Hussein formally cut all relations with and responsibility, and even to the point that the Jordanian radio would no longer give the weather report, Jerusalem and Ramallah.
How
and so
about
on.
This scenario that we know, at least through the press, that Jordan really is very concerned about the Palestinians having control over the border between Jordan and the Judea Samaria on the Jordan River. And Jordan also has a large Palestinian population. If the opportunity could arise that Jordan would be able to essentially reoccupy, maybe in a different format, but certainly have military control, security control, over the areas that are now will maybe eventually be some kind of reformulation of a Palestinian state with Jordanian presence, then that could very well happen under the right circumstances. So that by elevating the economic situation in the West Bank to a place where it would be in everybody's interest or desire to come there because of a lifestyle that's higher than the surrounding air region, that many of the Palestinians living in Jordan proper would be more inclined to move back into the West Bank, which would serve Jordan in two ways. One, it would alleviate Palestinian pressure in Jordan, and two, Jordan would have security control on the Palestinian population within the West Bank. Egypt has never wanted Gaza, but since we've moved out, it's created such a vacuum there, and Egypt, according to reports, has done everything in its power to allow the smuggling of arms, which will precipitate possibly Israel then marching in there or literally making Gaza one big crater out of protection for our population. And Egypt now has to take responsibility for Gaza once again, even if it's reluctant, because the rest of the world is demanding that. So all of a sudden, ironically, the two players who pretty much, like you said previously, have been exempt from any responsibility in those former areas that they controlled before the 67 war, and now in a position where they're being asked to in a very forceful way, below the radar, by the powers that be internationally to take responsibility. Quite interesting, because it's possible that the Palestinians, through their infighting and through their political and economic intrigue, could essentially create such a vacuum that those two forces will come in, fill the vacuum, and bring some kind of stability to allow some kind of economic revival, which certainly would, to some degree, be in our interests. This is going to be very interesting to see how this develops.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to bring this story up, Steve, is because it is very interesting, and it has, you know, roles and roles, layers and layers of possibilities. All of this, particularly from for the Jordanians to take a more active role in the West Bank, will require the Arab world, the Arab League, to agree, which they may not. They may feel that it's taking the burden off of Israel and letting us off the hook on a certain level, and that's not what they're interested in. They far prefer the people to suffer, which, you know, doesn't really bother anybody except for the West, and it bothers them to the point of being able to make propaganda from it. But I don't think they would agree to more Jordanian control in the West Bank if it took Israel off the hook, no matter what the cost to the Palestinians are of continuing in this netherland of not having any kind of... Because Israel now has refused. Don't forget, we've gone back in over the past few years back, and we feel perfectly free to send the army in, you know, day or night into any one of the Palestinian cities and villages. Yet we have not gone back to being in running the educational system, the sewers, the roads, and so on and so forth. So we've sort of chosen a very narrow area in which to operate there. And the other responsibilities, which for quite a few years we took on ourselves, we seem to no longer be involved in. And in many ways, it doesn't serve their purpose, because they can't point as easily to us as being at fault as they could when we were when we ran the business completely.
The geopolitical situation will be totally different. The Jordanians don't play around, and they're not going to allow, for their own personal interests and also the interest in the region, for any kind of third intifada, because it's not in anybody's interest. And I think that the Arab League is pretty much toothless. I see at least the possibility that internationally, even within the Arab region, it's growing tired of this rhetoric to destroy Israel. I think that it's running its course. It doesn't ignite the people all over the Arab world any longer. There's too many other important things happening socially, economically, politically, in their own countries. And I think that may be a good thing possibly for us, because it then allows the possibility of this new dynamic to be settling in here. People are growing tired and weary of the corruption in and out of the Palestinian areas and within the region.
I would like, Steve, with your permission, just to read the, I don't know what they call it, the sub-headline here. It's Arab leaders and Islamic groups are filling the vacuum left by the defeated and withering Palestinian national movement, and the PLO and institutions are becoming obsolete.
There's a piece written by Barry Rubin in today's Jerusalem Post, and it's called Combat Westophobia, and I thought it was made some really, I feel, very important points. One, he states that the idea that development or instability is caused by imperialism is so highly developed among the Western intelligentsia that it ignores the fundamental internal shortcomings that the real problems, understanding of the problems, and caused by traditional culture and the need for reform or the value of the virtues that led to Western successes. He also says, most revealing in this respect is the recent exchange between Syrian author Nidhal Naissa, I hope I pronounced his name right, and the Egyptian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim al-Kahuli on the Al Jazeera television. This happened on October 30th. I'm quoting now Rubin. Kahuli said, Western civilization is not really a civilization. And Naissa responded, saying, how do you come here from Qatar, from Egypt, in 2 hours? On camels? It used to take you over 6 months to make a pilgrimage. He also added, who developed the technology making it possible for you to speak to millions of people through the airways to a box with pictures and sounds. Then he says, other Arab liberals have pointed out that the ability to build airplanes is superior to the ability to crash them into buildings. He then makes one other comment here that I thought was interesting. He said, in this regard, the British student who lived in Syria has written a personal account entitled Syrian Journal, which is on the net, by the way, which reduces the prevailing myths about the region to rubble. It brilliantly portrays a dictatorship using repression, demagoguery, and modern public relation techniques to stay in power. And on the flip side, he said, it compares to a New York Times article on precisely the same topic, talking about how wonderful the Syrian regime is and has a pretty good society. So he says that confronted by the daily avalanche of naive nonsense or outright mendacity about the Middle East in the Western media, academia, and sometimes governments, I'm haunted by something a Syrian friend told a Syrian journal author. Quote, you know what pisses me off the most? Not the fascists here, meaning Syria, but the appeasers in the West. What sort of message is that sending to us, those of us who want some reform, who want our children to live in an open society like you have in the West? Because I think the time has come for us to really take a look and see that it is the oppression of the people in their respective countries is happening because of the repression of the government and their own people upon their own
their
people,
government.
Their governments. And the repression that they have politically, economically, and socially. Saudi Arabia has so much money. Iran has so much money from oil. And yet there is no serious industrialization there. There was never even an industrial revolution there.
Well, as we know, Iran doesn't even have oil refineries.
That's unbelievable.
So they can't even refine their oil into gasoline. They have to ship it out and then buy it back. Now, somebody's sending this stuff back
and
to them to run their tanks and planes
and
so
selling
on.
It on the street at such a low price, they're actually losing money to accommodate the people.
Well, that's how they're buying the people off.
Right. I mean, there's something inherently screwed up with this kind of, you know, approach that can't. It was only going to last as long as the oil is available, and the more the West decides to divest itself of dependency on oil, which it is doing because it has no choice at this point, then these areas, if they're not seriously changed in some way, economically, socially, and politically, is either going to destroy the rest of the world through modern technology, or they're going to be in the Middle Ages once again because of their arrogance and their unwillingness to give equality to the people, to their own people, their own citizens. And that's, I think, until the West comes to terms with that. And I think it's starting to take place. I think that there's a new regime in France. I think England is hanging in there in terms of understanding this situation. Germany is right in there for the most part, certainly with America. And, you know, Charles Krauthammer also had his article in today's Post. I'm not a great fan of Krauthammer's, but he does make the point that there's the new alliance is taking place. In spite of the hatred for Bush in America by liberals and even some conservatives, and the stupidity and the naivety of the regime in America and its unbelievable blindness towards how to deal with the Middle East. In spite of all of that, there is a certain understanding of the dangers that are taking place in the region and the need to address those head on. I think now, where we didn't have these allies in Western Europe, they're now coming aboard, and I think that's really crucial.
Well, as global warming catches on here, Steve, we may be reporting from a boat.
boat, huh?
Another item in this last week's Haaretz had, which is of November 16th, in the opinion section, Yoel Marcus, who's a longtime Haaretz opinion writer, and Daron Rosenblum have some interesting and I thought unusual comments to make. Marcus, there was a controversy here where Olmert made a statement that in order to carry on negotiations with the Palestinians, they would have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state.
God forbid.
And everybody made a big deal out of it. And then Nabil Shat, who's the chief negotiator, said the Palestinians will never recognize Israel as a Jewish state and so on.
What a political mistake.
Well, that's true. But as I've said, I think the issue itself, our focus on the issue is a mistake because it's an easy one. Actually, Shat, in this case, really did make a foolish mistake and an unnecessary one. because they will, they do recognize Israel as a Jewish state in a sense. So Yoel Marcus writes, "We exist and we are a Jewish state. The Arab countries that attacked after Israel's declaration of independence did so because it was a Jewish state." So he has some understanding here of the depth of and the width, really, at the same time, of the Arab antagonism towards us. And my claim is that being a Jewish state at this point in time and space is not the real significant issue. The real significant issue is the acceptance, the admission that we have a legitimate historical claim to any of the land between the river and the sea. And until that understanding is arrived at, they have to fight us, because then we are thieves. There's no reason that we came here other than to steal their land. And this is part of actually the issue that of the Nakba, which the Palestinians are so enamored of. Now, it's true, it was a catastrophe, the 1948 war. But the correlation, the what goes along with the Nakba, is the idea that the Jews came here to steal the Arab land, that the Jews, that the Arabs, the Palestinians, the Arabs who lived in this land are paying the price for the Holocaust, which happened in Europe. The Europeans should be paying the price. As if that is the reason we are here, in order, as a result of the Holocaust, we came here.
Ironically, though, it's not the reason we're here. With a recognition of us being an independent Jewish state, the Holocaust may have precipitated that.
The issue is that we're here at all. And the reason we're here at all is that we have a historical link to this place. Otherwise, why would we choose to come here of all places? There's no oil, there's no water, there's nothing here to attract us other than the opportunity to oppress the Palestinians. That's the way the Arab world and the Palestinians see this event. Is that we are here, we came here in order to steal their land. And the reason that we're stealing their land, that it's theft, is that we have no legitimate claim to any of it. Claim here because we have a previous historical connection to this piece of land, and it's the only piece of land in the world to which we have a historical connection that's ours. And therefore we came here, not because this was the greatest place, not because this place had some kind of fantastic opportunities of development and wealth, and not because the Arabs who were here were disorganized and didn't have their own national identity when we began. We came here because we have a legitimate historical claim to this land and only to this land. And until that's understood, and not understood by our force of forcing them to accept that, but by their own coming to that conclusion on their own, recognizing that historical reality, there can be no peace between us, and all the other concessions and with roadblocks and without roadblocks are totally meaningless.
I'm a little confused here. You originally said before that it wasn't so much that they needed to accept it, which I totally understand, in order for us to even get to the next step, which they may never in this lifetime, but the fact that we need to accept it. You said that just previously.
Well, we need to understand.
We need to accept it. We need to not have a doubt about it.
Well, that's why I emphasize that it's that the idea that we have a legitimate historical right to some of the land here. The tendency on the part of people who feel that we're here because of the history, the Bible, and God, tend to feel that we have a right to all of it and that nobody else has a right to any of it. And I think that's a real mistake. It's unrealistic.
I mean, we're talking about actually something that really is not political at all, in the sense that we're saying that we have experience and we know of the direct historical connection to this land.
And that's why we're here.
And that's the only reason
we're here.
No excuses, no apologies.
Right.
That's why we're all here in this crazy place.
But that doesn't mean that it's all ours. And in this time...
That's another issue.
That's true.
That's negotiable. Issue.
But I think it's important to state so that it's not seen as a statement about only us, and we are the only ones here with a just cause, and we're the only ones that have a historical connection. That's not true. Well, one of the reasons that I feel that this is very important, and I liken it to dealing with a diseased body. If somebody comes to the doctor with a headache and he gives them aspirin, and it turns out to be a brain tumor, that's not going to do him much good. I mean, the aspirin may relieve the pain for a little while, but the fundamental illness is still present and is not being dealt with. And here the fundamental pathology has to do with this recognition. And as long as we talk about other things, and you know, that Israel is a Jewish state, the acceptance of that, and when Netanyahu was prime minister, his whole focus was on terrorism. This is all about terrorism, and that's avoiding the one fundamental issue from which everything else stems, which is that we have a legitimate historical reason to be here, and that until that's realized and taught in the Arab schools, you know, when they begin the digging of the for the bridge by
Mugabe
the Temple
Bridge.
Mount,
yeah.
And there was a series of interviews with the Israeli Arabs, and several of the Israeli Arabs said, you know, the Jews have no business on the Temple Mount. It's not theirs, it's ours. And the fact that Israeli Arabs would have that idea, would not understand that there's something else going on here. It's not about we're right and they're wrong or they're wrong. It's about a historical reality and the understanding of that as being a major basic element in here. Now, you could argue with me and you say, but you don't have a historical right here because you left. Well, that's another argument, and that's an argument that would have a greater legitimacy and would at least be dealing with the core issue. And my feeling is that as long as we don't deal with the core issue, everything else that goes on around and all the energy,
but they don't want
everything
to.
Expended is a waste.
They can't afford to even get into that argument, because as soon as they in any way accept and admit that there was a Jewish presence here, then their arguments are then open to serious scrutiny. And that's one of the reasons they can't even say that we were even left and we forfeited our right to be here. Doesn't matter, we were pushed out or killed. Because as soon as they do that, they can't have a good example of that. Whenever they excavate anything on the Temple Mount, which our archaeologists here, who were mainly to the left and politically, when they scream that they're destroying all remnants of old Second Temple and even First Temple artifacts on purpose, and we don't do anything because we're afraid to stir up the pot, and when even Turkey now makes a statement, comes out with an official statement that while we're digging, fixing the bridge to the Temple Mount, that we're destroying Muslim artifacts, which is the biggest joke of all, because it wasn't Muslim artifacts we're destroying. We're taking out all all Jewish artifacts that are coming from that area. And they too, that element, doesn't want any recognition of a Jewish presence that dates back to the temple. And everybody knows it's there. Again, it's the emperor has no clothes, and everybody is in this region can't afford to say that, because the game is over then. That means that they do not have, within the Middle East, a legitimate right to the area.
This is an expression of the triumphalism of Islam, which even trumps the triumphalism of Christianity. You know, the Muslims claim that Abraham was the first Muslim, and the Jews have there's nothing to do with the Jews. They claim Joseph was a Muslim, and they even, and there was another program I'd like to talk about, a Muslim intellectual professor on Israeli television who even says the Muslims claim, and or he claims, that King Solomon was a Muslim. And of course, Jesus was a Muslim, and so on and so forth. So there's a kind of a triumphalism in Islam which I find really intolerable and reprehensible.
Well,
because there's no attempt, there's no understanding that there is some kind of an objective historical process involved. I also wanted to quote a little bit from Doron Rosenblum's article called "Going Through the Motions," and he says, "If we probe deeply into our hearts, even the hearts of the center-left," and for Rosenblum, the center-left is to the right, "it's doubtful we will find any burning passion for that piece people wax lyrically over in the annual Yahrzeit at Rabin Square." In other words, what he's saying is that even if you go as far as the center-left, as far off dead left, or as far as far left into the center-left, nobody really believes all these statements about the negotiations and about the willingness to discuss all the issues, and he makes quotes here, "and the conference will constitute a milestone in the realizations of the vision," and that the belief on our side also, and the exhaustion on our side of enthusiasm or involvement in this, is a truth that all of this language is attempting to deceive. I also think part of that truth is reflected in the fact that the high school teachers have been on strike now for a month. all these high school kids have, you know, are just roaming the streets, that the college professors have been on strike for nearly a month, and that the price of the basic foodstuff called bread is about to rise dramatically, is being accepted by the population with a kind of equanimity that seems very out of place. And
well,
I think it's a reflection
people.
Of the exhaustion of the our population.
I also, though, there were 100,000 people out in Rabin Square in support of the teachers, and got to be something pretty important to pull out, get 100,000 people on a Saturday night out of their houses, apartments.
Well, then maybe it's just the government that's exhausted, because the government is the one that needs to
this has been a disaster. I think the head of the Ministry of Education should resign. I think she's done a miserable job in dealing with the situation. And again, I think the government has failed us and failed the society fulfilling its promises to the teachers, and also dealing with a variety of issues that it's tried to avoid for the longest time, and no longer can they avoid them. I think we're about out of time.
Also, so let us indeed close it down.
And so you're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And
now we're going to listen to Rebbe Sol, Bruce Berger, HaTikva. Bruce has recently made Aliyah to Israel, and we'll soon have a program on interviewing him and listening to more of his good music.
That sounds great.